Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Wisconsin State Assembly Republicans found a legislative loophole to curtail bargaining rights of most public sector workers. A House committee held a hearing on the extent of radicalization of American Muslims, and President Obama broke his campaign promise by lifting a ban on Guantanamo trials. Joining us for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Lisa Lehrer, Bloomberg News, Shayla Murray of The Washington Post, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times. We'll welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
And since this is a week honoring women, I'm certainly glad to have you three here. Lynn Sweet, the impact of this tsunami not only felt in Japan, waves now hitting Hawaii, the question becomes, what can the U.S. do in a situation like this? The president has already offered help.
Well, one of the things that the administration is doing is trying to demonstrate from the moment, almost from the moment the president got news, 4 a.m. from Chief of Staff Bill Daley, that the White House was on top of the situation since the tsunami was headed to the western coast of the United States. So while the president and first lady did issue their condolences in a statement that came out at about 5 a.m. Eastern Time, they also said in the same statement that they are stand ready with federal emergency management authorities to help out the West Coast in case there is incredible damage.
The concern there in Japan is certainly about the people whose lives have already been lost. A ship has been lost, but now there is concern about a nuclear power plant. Shayla.
Well, that's right. They don't understand. They're not sure the extent of the damage of this, both earthquake and the water that's come after it. And as they try to investigate this, I think it is opening up a whole new challenge for the president and certainly all of the whole world as they try to respond to this new front of chaos. The Middle East is a jump ball, and now we have a massive catastrophe in Asia that's already affecting the markets, affecting oil prices, and, could have ripple effects just as pronounced as the Middle East.
And speaking of those oil prices, the Republicans, Lisa Lehrer, are using rising gas prices to attack President Obama.
Right. We're getting into the summer driving season. We're getting closer. Oil prices are going up. So in Washington, that, of course, means the return of drill, baby, drill, and the fight that we seem to have almost every year between Republicans and Democrats over domestic oil exploration, how much exploration to do at home. Economically, though, it's important to note that this rise in oil prices is a little bit different than what happened in 2008, largely because since then the country has become a little bit more energy efficient. Cash for clunkers, people have more efficient, fuel-efficient cars, there's more use of natural gas. So, of course, the economic impacts will depend on how high prices are, how long they're high, but it might not be quite as bad in terms of the hampering the recovery as 2008 was.
There's been a push from Republicans to open the strategic oil reserves in order to try to bring down prices temporarily. Do you see the president doing that, Shayla?
I don't expect him to. This debate always surfaces, and when gas prices go up, it's true, as Lisa says, that the brunt of these high gas prices hasn't really been felt, or you just hear people complaining about it now, even though they've been on the rise for over a year. I think 17% last year and about 12% so far this year. But economists do think that once it gets to about $4.40 a gallon, that you could potentially see a collision between the recovery and oil and gas prices, where it really starts to influence the way businesses hire people and the decisions people make about finding work. So the president has met this challenge before. In 2008, high gas prices turned out to be a really good issue for him. He refused to concede on this idea of a gas tax holiday that Senator McCain and Senator Clinton were both proposing. He scored a lot of points for that, for holding fast, and but he will have to, if the prices continue to rise, he'll have to confront it, and we expect he will begin to do that in his press conference today.
Lisa.
Right, and of course the economic brunt of this will be borne on people who have, you know, lower income people, because more of their more of their money has to go towards necessities like food or like gas. And those are people who are already hurting in this economy. They're the people who are most frustrated, who maybe they're out of work or they're struggling, you know, to meet their mortgage payments or they're in foreclosure. So that's also something he'll have to deal with, especially as a lot of their benefits get cut with state budgets feeling so strapped.
And certainly we're going to, and have already seen, rises in the cost of airfare. Lynn Sweet, let's talk about the latest standoff in Wisconsin and what the Wisconsin State Assembly has done.
Well, the Wisconsin Republicans, led by the Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, did an end run on the state Democrats who are hiding out in northern Illinois, and they managed to pass legislation that stripped unions of some of their collective bargaining rights, which was the whole point of the runaway Democrats, to try and prevent that from happening. That's why you had all the protesters. So what this does is become a blow to unions in the very short term. On the other hand, as one union official told me, nationally it has perhaps awakened unionism. And here's one thing it has done for the Team Obama. They used this protest in Wisconsin to galvanize their troops, Obama for America, which became Organizing for America, which will become part of the Obama 2012 reelect, was activated to help the demonstrators there. And Wisconsin, which is not a dependable Obama state anymore with the Republican sweep, you know, you have the governor, Russ Feingold, was defeated. They have used this as an organizing tool.
But, you know, there's a lot of questioning as to whether this move was actually legal. What the GOP did was strip the bill of some fiscal measures that require a 20-member quorum for actions, and then passed it with an 18-1 Republican majority.
Right. The big legal questions, it seems, or the major legal questions, are whether this violated a rule in Wisconsin that's an open meetings rule. They have to give 24 hours notice of any public meeting. There's a dispute over whether that happened, and also whether they actually stripped out all the fiscal components of the bill. And this is a political problem for Scott Walker as well, who's seen his numbers just drop since he came into office, 20 points or so. Because his major argument for stripping out the collective bargaining was that this is something that hampers local and state governments' ability to deal with their budgets. So then if he's now turning around and saying, this is not a fiscal issue, I was able to pass this non-fiscal bill, I think that's going to raise a lot of questions for people in the state and open them up to some attacks.
Well, he's already been open up to attacks. Anytime you use a legislative sleight of hand, it goes to the courts. This is true of many states and many general assemblies, whatever you want to call it, in state legislatures. You do a sleight of hand, you get a short-term gain, which Scott Walker really needed because he's been getting beat up the wazoo, looking like he cannot manage. So even if you think that he's right on the issue, he's not managing it. Short-term gain, long-term lawsuit.
But there are already efforts to overturn what's happened here, Shayla.
There are, and there are also recall efforts waged against both Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature. But I think that this Wisconsin debate also raises a bigger question about the style versus substance approach to that these governors are taking to their fiscal problems. And you see in some other states, Indiana, for instance, New Jersey, governors taking a more direct and sort of working within the system to try to enact these massive cuts. And I think for Governor Walker, the challenge maybe that he failed to meet was guiding his state through these rocky waters and trying to bring people along with him, even people who may agree with what he was trying to do in principle. Are not going to like the way he went about it because people don't want that kind of disruption. And states, these states have been in crisis for a long time. This is not a new issue
sure,
for these states.
But what about the Democrats who hid for this period of time trying to avoid this vote altogether, Lisa?
Right. Well, if you're questioning sort of the legality and the tactics used by Scott Walker, I think people also have to question the tactics used by the Democrats. But one thing's sure, that it's made them, the party, it's certainly benefited the party. And as Lynn mentioned, they've been fundraising out the wazoo. I think overnight, some liberal groups raised $500,000, you know, last night after they passed the first part of this.
After the vote. Lisa Lehrer, she's politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Shayla Murray is a reporter for The Washington Post. Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and a columnist at politicsdaily.com. Short break. We'll be back with more and your questions and comments. Stay with us. And we're back this week with Lisa Lehrer, Bloomberg News, Shayla Murray of the Washington Post, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, and politicsdaily.com. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Yesterday, Congressman Peter King chaired a hearing on the radicalization of Muslims in America. What came out of this hearing, Lisa?
Well, this hearing was certainly a target for a lot of controversy on both sides. And in part, that wasn't so much because the topic. It was because who was chairing it. Congress has had a number of hearings on whether American Muslims are becoming radicalized. But Congressman King is known for using particularly inflammatory rhetoric when he talks about this. For example, one thing he said in an interview two or three years ago was that there's too many mosques in America. That came up in the hearing, and he said, well, I wasn't saying there's too many mosques. I was saying that they don't participate with law enforcement. They don't, and that didn't necessarily help his cause in terms of calming down the rhetoric, which I'm not sure he wants to do anyhow. So it attracted a lot of attention.
And it was pretty emotional at one point, Lynn.
It was Congressman Keith Ellison, who is a Muslim, one of two in the House of Representatives, cried when he was telling his story. The hearing had a lot of personal stories in it rather than any new facts that came out of it, which I would think is something that Congressman King might want to think about. If that was the result of it, was it worth all the tumult and uproar? By the way, I bet he'll say yes, because he thought this was important just to throw a spotlight on the subject, even if the hearing itself did not yield any new information about the subject at hand.
Shayla.
That's right. I mean, there were stories on both sides that were gripping stories. Others talked about how relatives had joined up with extremist forces, and certainly that is a concern within the Muslim community among some young people. There are factions just like there are within any group. And I think that Chairman King was pretty much up against the rail right there when he decided to focus on this one group without necessarily a lot of information or facts to back up. I mean, it's certainly a valid concern, but it's hard to paint with such a broad brush there.
Lisa.
And I think that kind of tactic has hurt the Republicans with that community. I saw something interesting the other day was that George W. Bush, who made a lot of outreach to the Muslim community, won something like 80% of the vote in 2000. 2008, Obama won over 80-90% of the American Muslim vote. And that's because this group, which could, you know, maybe be a swing group, they're socially conservative. They tend to be, a lot of them maybe are small business owners. They're economically more conservative. But they've really been turned off by some of the rhetoric. And also, if you remember, some of the from the Republican Party, and also some of the accusations made in the 2008 elections that President Obama was secretly a Muslim or something like that, which, of course, were not true. So that shift has been interesting to watch.
And it was interesting to hear Peter King sort of lash out against those who believed that these hearings were irresponsible.
He did that in his opening statement.
I thought he was
highly defensive. I thought he did not need to go as far as he did in justifying what he was doing, because up until his defensive opening statement, he said he wasn't going to be captive of political correctness, and this is a subject that needed to be talked about.
Lisa Lehrer, let's talk about the status of federal budget negotiations. We are at a standoff, are we?
Well, the latest is that they're talking about doing another 3-week extension of funding, which would be accompanied by a $6 billion spending cut. And that's something that that's a strategy that Republicans think is working for them, because every 2 weeks or a month they get to cut some spending, and that, you know, helps, gives them a little political boost. They seem like they're, you know, implementing these spending cuts, and they're all sort of still low-hanging fruit. And it's something that the White House really and Democrats think has been very hurtful for them, because it doesn't allow them to get ahead of this issue or regain any momentum.
Republicans want $60 billion by the end of September, when the fiscal year actually ends. Will they get that much?
Well, we have to wait and see. These smaller bills are a prorated amount of that amount.
I see.
Some of them think that they can get there by just doing all these smaller bills. Economically, that could be pretty difficult for people. It doesn't give the economy much certainty. It doesn't give business much certainty. But a lot of Republicans, particularly freshmen who make up a third of the caucus in the House, think that they can hang tough on that $61 billion number.
What about the Pentagon, Lynn?
The Pentagon? Well, one of the issues is always cutting defense spending, because no one wants to be accused of being soft on defense. So some of the spending will, you know, I think there is some unanimity. One of you can help me out there. Is it not a tanker? Is it the F?
It's the alternative engine. Fighter plane.
Right, for one of the big fighter planes. I think there is some cross-aisle consensus on reducing that program. You'll have some,
which was in Congressman Boehner's backyard.
Yes.
And many members' backyard.
Right.
Right. So I you can nip and tuck. You're talking about a budget so big, though, that to make significant cuts, billions upon billions, you have to, you know, you just have to do a lot, than even cutting a significant weapons program or plane program.
How much public support is there for these cuts, Shayla?
I think there's a lot of public support for the concept of these cuts. I think some of the particular cuts are not going to be popular, especially the ones that seem people generally accept as being helpful, things that safety net issues that there, where there's no other alternative in communities like community health centers, for instance. But the I think the challenge for both parties is going to be getting out of the short-term debate, which is just a massive distraction for Congress. Every 2 weeks, they have to pass another one of these bills.
Exactly.
And I think they're hoping to string these out long enough to get the debate on the budget going, which will begin in the middle of April. And then they can start tackling some of these bigger issues that really make a difference, like the Pentagon budget, agricultural subsidies, which Democrats are willing to put on the table. Democrats want to raise, take some tax breaks away from oil and gas companies. It'll be interesting to see if they continue advocating that idea if gas prices stay high. So I think the country and certainly people in both parties are ready to have this big fiscal debate, and it could take several years, but they can't get there until they resolve the short-term problem.
But long-term, they've got to look at Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that there's going to be a fair amount of education that members of Congress are going to have to do. Bloomberg, we had a poll this week that said that showed that a majority of people thought that you could really make a dent in the budget by cutting foreign aid. And that's just not true. I mean, it's such a small percentage of the budget.
It's less than 1%.
Right. So, I mean, that's a tough thing for members of Congress, because although people do support spending cuts, I think there are questions about, you know, whether people really understand what it will take to get to a place where the budget is more balanced.
And let's talk about Guantanamo. Why did President Obama come out with a reverse policy, Lynn?
And he now is supporting military trials. This has just been a subject that Obama could not deliver on. It was a big topic in his campaign. He made a pledge to close Guantanamo
right. The
day he was sworn in. He said it will be closed a year from now. He set in motion buying a unused prison in Illinois to buy for – they have the federal government buy to house the prisoners there. So where are we now? Not only the basis, you know, – the prison is open. The prison is – the idea to send people to America of the detainees is shut down. And lo and behold, he's come to the conclusion that the only thing to be done with them is pretty similar to what George Bush was suggesting.
But why? Shayla.
Well, Republicans shut him down on this. They very cleverly denied any funding to move these prisoners or open this prison in Illinois. And there are members of Obama's administration and certainly a lot of Democrats who thought he got too far out ahead on this issue, moving forward with it right away after taking office. Without a strategy for making it happen. And when there's money involved, that means Congress can get in and stop something. And so that strategy probably wasn't well thought through, and he's paying the price.
Lisa.
Sheila's exactly right. This was a recognition of what the political realities were. And the political realities is that Congress was going to block moving these folks, these detainees, for trial. So the administration had to deal with the reality of Gitmo and find a way to make it work more efficiently, put in more checks where they could, you know, reviews for the status of the prisoners every
right.
year.
Because they were not comfortable with the idea of indefinite detention.
Right. Right. But in a way, they institutionalized Gitmo. I mean, it's here to stay. This is
exactly.
going to be a long-term situation. So even if the political realities change, I think, which seems unlikely.
Do you agree with that, Lynn? Gitmo is here to stay?
Yeah, yes, in the short term. You'll have attrition. It won't be here 50 years now. You'll have attrition. And one of the things the administration was able to do in some cases in the last few years was transfer some of the detainees to other countries. Now, of the numbers that are left, and it will dwindle, there may be some people, I'm not sure, who are still eligible for transfer if you find an appropriate country. They might not have anything in the pipeline now, but it is a short-term problem when you look at the problem, but it's one that wouldn't be solved during the Obama first term or even a second one if he gets it.
All right. Speaking of short and long-term problems, let's talk about what's happened at NPR with the resignation of Vivian Schiller with the immediate withdrawal of another young man by the name of Schiller, no relation, Lynn.
Well, this really follows up on our budget talk. NPR has been in the crosshairs of Republicans for many years, as has PBS. If you look at the whole budget problem we have, even if you cut it, it's not going to make the big dent that that is needed to get the budget in shape, won't reduce the deficit. But this is a symbolic issue. It's a red-hot issue, and NPR officials stumbled into just some messes. In this last mess with the, I'm going to call it a so-called sting from right-winging operatives, was it a setup? Yeah. Did they get caught in it? Yeah. Bad timing. And it doesn't help now that this is the very time when their money's at risk.
Lynn Sweet, she's Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, a columnist at politicsdaily.com. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Lisa Lehrer, you were about to say something.
Oh, I was going to say that that Diane, I'm sorry, but I think the funding is going to get cut in Congress. That seems to be how the momentum is looking there. There were some moderates of both sides that came out and defended NPR as a place where maybe the rhetoric was less heated than other, you know, more partisan stations. But I think any time that you're a target in this environment where the focus is so much on spending cuts, it's likely that the money will be cut.
House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said after Vivian Schiller's resignation on Wednesday, quote, NPR has admitted that they don't need taxpayer subsidies to thrive, and we certainly agree with them, end quote. That was taken from that surreptitiously recorded conversation when Mr. Schiller said, well, we really don't need federal monies. We have to think not only about the big stations around the country who have many listeners who will contribute, but smaller entities out in the rural areas who rely on NPR, PBS, and all of public broadcasting. Sheila, do you agree with Lisa that there will be major cuts? And if so, what's your guess?
I think so. I think that there's nothing worse than living up to your own stereotype. And in this one instance, we see all kinds of worst-case scenarios for NPR, the comments about the Tea Party, and conservatives being racist, the meeting with a Muslim, a fake Muslim organization, dredging up the same things that these hearings in the House yesterday tapped into as well. And I think that maybe this is an opportunity for public radio to seek a new business model or show some effort to change and. I think it's going to be necessary.
Remind us of who James O'Keefe is.
Well, he is a, I'm going to say, rogue operator who has been part of these stings before. He is best known for being one of the players in the video dealing with the Acorn officials. Acorn is the group that deals a lot with public housing issues. And they were able to create a video, and I say create because it was edited, that ended up being an embarrassment to Acorn and basically more or less put the organization out of business.
Lisa.
And, of course, we recently saw a similar video operation with Planned Parenthood where they were accused of giving help to women who were working as prostitutes. So it's sort of become a trend in the conservative universe to do these video stings.
Well, and you would think, though, that people would be on the alert at this point. If somebody comes in with an offer that's too good to be true, it probably isn't.
So, you know, NPR currently has serious funding threats, has no CEO, no head of news, and no head of development.
And you're doing just fine today.
Yes.
Well, that's WAMU, okay, an affiliate of NPR. And remember, we are an affiliate. NPR is the behemoth, and we are the satellite radio stations.
Well, and ironically, this coincides with a time when people from the outside looking at NPR see an organization performing at the peak of its power. It has an excellent website. It has more authority than ever, I think, as a news force.
Oh, right. Actually, and very good point. They're one of the growing news organizations. This is an important point. When you have so many national outlets with shrinking staffs, NPR is one of the few national outlets that is growing and is creating more original content than other national outlets.
Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief of the Chicago Sun-Times. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Libyan leader Gaddafi draws on hordes of cash to extend the fight against opposition rebels. Sectarian violence in Egypt grows, and the global impact of the huge earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan earlier today. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to open the phones. We'll go first to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning, Diane. I just want to say I am a little disgusted by Peter King. I believe he's a hypocrite and a political opportunist. And the reason is, in the past, he was a supporter of the IRA, and I think he was quoted as saying at one time that if citizens get killed in the line of fire against the British Army, that was just the cost of business. And I'm sure his speech in New York areas in his district, which was highly full of Irish Americans, where they collected money for the IRA. So for him, it's okay if we support terrorist organizations in other countries, and this is one of our major allies. And the second thing I would like to say is I have no problem with congressional hearings on hate groups and things like that. But let's have it on all hate groups. I mean, we have people on the right like Michelle Bachmann and Palin, who keep on calling people, you know, if you hate your government, a call to arms. But it's okay if you say that if you're in the mainstream. But can you imagine what would happen if you had a Muslim in the mainstream saying, well, if you hate the government, call to arms.
All right.
The whole world would fall down. It's a double standard. And to also vilify Muslims is just terrible like this.
Thanks for calling, Vincent. Shayla.
Well, that's the danger zone that you enter.
Putting it very vividly.
Yes, very well put, Vincent. And when you wade into this sort of territory, you're going to have to deal with Peter King. I mean, the caller is right, has a long history of association with IRA leaders. He's close friends with Jerry Adams. I've seen them together at many events. And
well, Jerry Adams did become part of
that's
the
right.
government.
Exactly. And Peter King would argue that you know, he supports the Sinn Féin cause in Northern Ireland, independence from Great Britain and all that, and that's totally legitimate. But you open the door to criticism when you start training your focus on other groups that have similar ambiguities within them and trying to separate the vast mainstream, especially, I mean, Irish Americans have been dealing with this sort of issue for decades where you're stereotyped and
sure.
So he's learned his lesson.
Lynn?
Well, I think Shayla put it quite well. King exposed himself by having these hearings, by focusing on one ethnic minority in the United States. And he said he wasn't going to, as I said before, he wasn't going to be a captive of political correctness. So certainly he didn't get any benefit of the doubt from people looking at his own past. One of the things you do when you raise your profile like this is to get more scrutiny on your own life and your own record.
All right. To DeConte in Laurel, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Hello?
Hi.
Yes. You know, I'm calling about, you know, the NPR CEO, you know, that was forced, you know, to resign. I think that NPR did that exact wrong thing because Fox News and Washington Times, you know, are not listening to what the White House has to say, you know, how they influence how they run their corporations. You know, I think sometimes NPR try to please people that will never support NPR, you know, and its policies.
All right. Thanks for calling. Shayla.
I think the problem here for NPR is the word public. Fox News doesn't present itself as a mainstream news organization. Certainly does not rely on taxpayer funding or even viewer funding, for that matter. The where NPR has got itself into trouble is the fact that it has this government funding overlay, and I think that it's going to be held to a different standard as a result of that.
All right, let's read an email here from Steffi, who says, people who don't want their small percentage of tax money going to NPR don't seem to realize that there are as many of us who object to a large amount of our tax money going to support two wars in which we don't believe. I think they need to be reminded we can't always get what we want. Interesting point. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Karen. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to say that I believe Scott Walker will come out okay, even if he were to be successfully recalled, because I would think that the Koch brothers will take care of him financially and compensate him if he's, you know, a sacrificial lamb. And I feel he'll do like Ms. Palin. He can write a book, go on speech tours where he can paint himself as being victimized by liberals and those on the left.
All right, Karen, talk about the Koch brothers, Lisa Lehrer.
Well, first of all, Scott Walker, I think it's important to point out they can't be recalled till 2012. So he has some time to sort of see how this all plays out. But the Koch brothers came into the front of this debate. They had given him a decent amount of money during his reelection campaign. And then he was spoofed similar to the NPR executive. Someone called him. A liberal reporter from New York called him and pretended to be one of the Koch brothers and had a whole long 20-minute conversation.
Same kind of duping that NPR experience.
Right. Makes you want to not answer the phone.
Well, exactly. I mean, there is, let's face it, there's a lot of it out there on all sides, and we need to acknowledge that.
You do, and I just want to point out to your listeners, too, that deception is not how real journalists, it's not a tool real journalists often use. I mean, I'm excluding some undercover probes where people are doing serious
work. Well, you know,
work,
60 Minutes used to go in with hidden cameras. ABC goes in.
But hidden cameras are different than deception. If I, you know,
Why?
Why? Because you don't, in this case, they're saying that there's somebody who they're not, as opposed to just observing.
Well, but they've done the same thing.
There's a decent amount of baiting, I think, that goes on in these calls, particularly the Scott Walker call.
Absolutely.
You know, the journalist talking to him kept saying, well, don't you want me to give you more money? Things like this, like trying to, we'll look out for you, trying to get him to say something inflammatory. So I think the baiting is also very problematic.
All right. To Kentucky, I think it's Katie's Kentucky, and to Gay. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. I wanted to comment on the Peter King hearing that he's having. He's targeting Muslims, which I don't have a big problem with that. But why not the other hate groups like the Kansas Westboro Baptist Church that is targeting our military, over 1,000 funerals that they have put up their hate speech? And then our Supreme Court condones it. It's just unbelievable. This James O'Keefe, he's also illegally recording conversations, and I believe he's using a cell phone. And in many states, you can't record somebody on a phone without telling them they're being recorded.
And the small issue of surreptitious recording, nowadays, people have so many recording devices on them. You know, I have in my hand, listeners, a BlackBerry. I could take a picture. I could take a video. I can make a phone call on it. Even if people are walking around as walking.
Privacy is gone.
Right. And so, and I just think a lot of people might not be aware of the law. Certainly, many states, it is. Maybe people don't know this out there, that you just cannot record over a phone line a conversation. But if we're sitting at a restaurant and somebody can hear us and they turn on a device or a video device, you know, this is a warning for people. This is outside of any news context, just to be careful.
Hey, we see it all the time. We saw it in the 2008 campaigns where reports came out of closed fundraisers, live mics being left on, and all sorts of television pundits getting in trouble. It seems like technology has definitely enabled more of these private, nothing's private anymore. Emails get forwarded.
No question. No. You may hit reply to all as opposed to reply to one. To Independence, Missouri. Good morning, David. Good morning, David.
Diane, you've been there 32 years. NPR has been there for 40 years. I think you can cut the umbilical cord and go out there like Fox and the other news agencies without any problem.
When you say cut the umbilical cord, you mean to the government contribution. Just to be clear about what WAMU gets in the way of federal money, it's something like $975,000. Now, we, in order to make up that money, would have to recruit some 8,000 new donors who would, and have to do that in a single year, who would then give continuously at least $135 over a number of years. We'll see what happens. I myself do not believe that the cut will be to zero. I don't think that the Democrats in the Senate or the House are going to flatten public broadcasting down to zero. To Susanville, California. Hi, Brian.
Hello. I just want to make a comment on, you know, I work for the federal government, and I just, it's kind of unstable for the federal workers because we're working in an environment that we're not sure if we're going to be furloughed, or we're not even sure what type of projects that we're going to be able to actually do because we don't know what the funding is going to be like.
That's a really good point that Brian makes. And that's what's at stake here for the unions. Public sector employees have become the backbone of unions as union enrollment has dropped for private sector employees. The public sector employees have stayed stable. And so how this plays out in Wisconsin and whether we see similar moves to ban collective bargaining across the country will definitely, play a huge part in what the future of unionization is.
But you can't, to Brian's point, you can't fund the government at 2-week intervals. And it's not just the workers who don't know whether they're going to be furloughed. It's all the student loan checks and all the many tentacles of government that are just totally at loose ends right now. And I think both parties want to bring some certainty to this. Even if they can't agree on terms.
That's the question. Right. Will they be able to?
I think so, but I think it'll take a while to draw out.
Shayla Murray, she's a reporter for The Washington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show to Liverpool, New York. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. I have a question on Wisconsin, on the situation in Wisconsin.
Sure.
I understand that the police and the fire unions were excluded from this legislation, and I was wondering if that is legal, that that they can just exclude them and not have that go together with all the rest of them. And one of the reasons I ask is because I read somewhere or heard that that those were the only two unions that backed the governor and the Republican Party in the fall elections,
and that is absolutely the case, that the police and fire unions did back the governor. Whether it's legal to exclude them from this, I have no idea. But nobody challenged the governor on that particular point. So let's go back to the phones. To Jim in Reston, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air. Jim.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. Go right ahead, sir.
Hi, Ms. Rehm. I'll be quick because I know there isn't much time. I love your show. I just wanted to say that I think that NPR definitely makes a very sincere effort to cover all sides of an issue. I can see that, and I immensely respect the network, and at the same time, I think that more could be done. For example, a lot of the discussion today has focused on why the sting occurred, in other words, how the entrapment was able to occur, and what people can look for in the future to avoid being recorded without their consent. But I think that's really the wrong kind of soul-searching to ask. The fact that the recording occurred and some inappropriate things were recorded, that's the real issue. And, I think that, I'm not a conservative person myself. I tend to be very liberal-leaning, but I have some colleagues who are conservative, and I found that a lot of their issues are very legitimate and very valid.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. I don't think we have focused exclusively on how to make sure you avoid such a sting. Obviously, the wrong things were said.
Right. And in all due respect to your caller, I think the action of NPR and the fact that these key people are not with the organization anymore speaks to your point. We were just moving on from there.
All right. And just to let our listeners know, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has signed the bill taking away public collective bargaining rights. And the first waves from the tsunami caused by a Japanese earthquake have reached the U.S. mainland along the Oregon coast. geophysicist Gerard Fryer at the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Honolulu says high water reached Portland, Oregon around 7:30 Pacific time on Friday. So lots of weather news out there, lots of other news as well, and the death of David Broder, Lynn Sweet.
David Broder, who I was privileged to know, fellow Illinoisan, is often called, had been often called, the dean of the Washington Press Corps for his shoe leather reporting and his ability to write both columns and news. He will be missed, and he was just a top reporter and a very decent guy.
Superman. We ran a rebroadcast of a conversation I did with him back in 2000. Last night. Thank you all. Lisa Lehrer, Shayla Murray, Lynn Sweet. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.